I'm going to talk about the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita, however, is a part of a very long allegory, the Mahabharata, as you all know. And if we talk about the allegory from the outside in, it's very easy to take an allegorical story and weave all kinds of meanings into it. And so what I want to do is begin with the subject, which is man. I want to trace it first by showing men are wiser than they know. And you will recognize yourself in some of the things that I'm talking about. If we talk about it from the scripture, it can seem like a myth. If we talk about it from our own experience, we can say, well, yes, I understand that. And so this allegory is entirely a story of man, of his descent into matter and of his ascent back into spirit again. The Battle of Kurukshetra is the war between good and evil. But we don't understand what that war is, and so let me go into it more deeply. The war is that the war takes place in the spine. And you know yourself whenever you feel happy, you feel uplifted. You sit up straight, you look up, you smile. Everything about you feels light. When you feel depressed or unhappy, everything about you becomes heavy. You sit with a slumped attitude, you walk with a bent back, you look down, you frown. All these things indicate a downward movement in the spine. Now, what this story is about really is the action in the spine. We will have to understand that all our striving takes place inside, not outside. For example, when you see a beautiful sunset, you think, oh, that's a beautiful sunset. But it's not the sunset that makes you feel that way. It's something in you. There's a reaction to it. You see an ice cream cone, and it's your reaction that makes you want that. Otherwise, you wouldn't want it. Everything begins with you. It's your reaction to the positive and negative aspects of life that determine their realities for you. A turtle could look at a sunset and wonder, if anything, whether it's something to eat. You look at it and you say it's beautiful. There's another aspect to it too, and it's a very worthwhile thing to think about, that all nature is a symbol. For example, you look at the beautiful clouds and the sunset. Then, after a few minutes, when the sun goes down, those same beautiful clouds become gray and unlovely. So we must understand that the beauty that we see in man is because God's light shines upon him. And when a person lacks light, he becomes dull and colorless. The whole caste system was set up on that basis. The caste system was not meant to be hereditary. The caste system, rather, was meant to be the individual, not who your parents were, but who you are. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says that even the worst of sinners, that means a Shudra or even worse, quickly attains me if he steadfastly meditates on me, takes my name, and loves me. This means that a Shudra in one lifetime can become a Brahmin. The son of a Brahmin may be a Shudra. The son of a Shudra may be a Brahmin. We must get rid of this outward fallacy of thinking that one group of people are better than another. The wish of human beings is always to be able to look down or to find someone to look down upon. The truth is, the whole caste system is intended to be, this is the true races of man. It's supposed to show you the direction of development. And in one sense, that direction is in the spine. In another sense, that direction is social. But the truth is that as our energy rises, let us speak of man when he first arrives on the scene as a human being. We go through, the Shastras say, some 5 to 8 million lives before we reach the human level. That's a long time. But you have to go through many different forms. And you know, even the rocks are conscious. This is something that was very difficult to talk about until recently, because people didn't know this. Shankaracharya couldn't teach these things to people. They wouldn't know what he was talking about. But now that science has shown us that matter is energy, we can understand that even the rocks are energy. They don't have form, really. They only are a cohesive sort of glob of energy. And scientists have shown us, and this is where the benefit of science is, it has shown us many truths. It is materialistic, but even its own method is taking people gradually toward a non-materialistic view of the universe. And so an increasing number of scientists today are saying that it looks very much as though that energy were really a manifestation of consciousness. The thoughts, God created, and this is what my guru explained to me, that God created the universe first in thought. The stillness of spirit, there's no movement there. And when he decided to create, he put the wind of movement into the ether, and the surface of his consciousness moved and created waves, and that was vibration. And so you have Sat, beyond all creation. Then you have Om, which is creation itself, and the moving waves that produce all the vibrations of the universe. And then you have Tat, which is the relation. This is the Kutastha Chaitanya, the relation of spirit, which is at the heart of every point in the universe, because the reflection of God, the spirit, has to be present in nature. God, in creating nature, didn't create something separate from himself. It is himself. And so that the center of every particle of movement in the universe, there has to be that one unmoving Christ consciousness, Kutastha Chaitanya, Krishna consciousness, whatever you want to call it. But that is the heart of everything. And so, as my guru put it in his great book, Autobiography of a Yogi, he said, even the atom is dowered with individuality. Now that atom, with that individual consciousness, must evolve gradually. And it is said nowadays, people in their blindness think that someday computers will become complex enough and intelligent enough to be able to be conscious and to be able to, they even have talked of someday having to have computer rights. It's so funny when you think of that. What could be simpler than a worm? And yet if you prick a worm with a pin, it'll wriggle away. It feels, and it thinks, I have to protect myself. Those two things science will never be able to produce, feeling and self-consciousness. These are the essence. Intelligence is not the essence. You can get a computer that can be more intelligent than man, but it is not conscious. It has no feeling. We must realize that this essence, this is why when Patanjali gave his definition of yoga in his Yoga Sutras, he said, yogas chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga is the neutralization of the waves or vortices, really, of chitta or feeling. So your feeling element is the essence of your reality. And this battle of Kurukshetra is the rising, it begins with the rising of the soul in feeling. The worm feels, but it can't clearly define. The insects feel, they feel enough, but they don't clearly define. When you reach the animals, they become conscious and a little bit self-conscious. I remember when I was a boy in Romania. I grew up there, I was born there. And we had a little dog called Jasper. He was a little Scottish terrier. And one time my brother, Bob, went out with this terrier, a Scotch terrier, and the pound people came and they saw this dog and they thought they could take that dog to the pound and keep it for a ransom to get some money out of it. And so they tried to catch him in a net, and my brother Bob held their net like this, and he'd, run, Jasper, run! And so Jasper ran. And at a certain point, when the pursuers were out of sight, he hid behind a bush, and then they went charging past him. He came trotting home, every time we were very proud of him for his intelligence, and every time when we talked about this episode of his very proudly, he might be sitting under a table, but as soon as we began talking about it, he went, he knew what we were talking about. He knew that we were talking about him. You see, there's some ego there in the animals too. Of course there is. Not just the self-protection of a worm, but more than that, a sense of this body is mine to protect, and he was aware enough to know. But it's only at man that the ego level really begins to come into play. It's an interesting thing that animals have tails, because we have come up from the lower level up into the spine. The tail represents the downward movement of energy in the spine. Here's another interesting thing. In the Mahabharata, you find that when Arjuna wins Draupadi and he takes her home, and he says to his mother that I have brought a prize home, and she says to him that you must share her equally with all. And so Draupadi has to do something that, as far as I know, they only do in Tibet, where one woman marries several men, several brothers. But in India, that's not a tradition. Draupadi's marriage with the five Pandavas has a deep meaning. The five Pandavas stand for the five chakras in the spine. And Draupadi's marriage, Draupadi stands for Kundalini. And when that Kundalini comes up, it has to unite with each chakra before it can attain freedom in the Kutastha and at the Sahasrara. These are subtle truths, and I want to talk about them in these discussions here. Because until you understand them, you cannot understand really what the Gita is about. You can get many side benefits from it, because it's a deep truth. And if you take a central truth, you can always go off in many directions from that. The more central the truth, the more explanations you can give. Another very interesting story is Chaitanya. When he moved to Puri, there was a saint there, very wise man called Sarvabhauma. And Chaitanya had been a very highly intellectual man, a famous professor. But when he learned to love Krishna, he left everything, and he just used to sing the name of Krishna. He said, Hare Nam, Hare Nam, Hare Nam Kevalam. Only God's name, only God's name, only God's name, only. And so he was only chanting Maha Mantra. And Sarvabhauma said, well, this sweet, shining young man needs to know more than that. So he came and offered to teach him. And Chaitanya was very humble, and he said, well, yes, I'd be very glad to learn. So Sarvabhauma took a passage of scripture, I don't know what the passage was, and interpreted it 25 different ways. And Chaitanya said, well, that's a marvelous job, well done. Let's see if I can think of any other. And he came up with some 80 more. Well, this to me was a very interesting statement and story, because where I was brought up in the West, we've been trained in Aristotelian logic. A thing is either this or that. We try to pin down the one true meaning of something. And in fact, it was the one thing that caused me at one point to have a certain doubt in my guru's wisdom. I didn't doubt that he was my guru, but I had this doubt which came from past lives. Doesn't he know what he's talking about? Can he make up his mind? He would say when interpreting the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, it means this, on the other hand, it also can mean that, and it can also mean that, and I thought, well, what is this? But I came, especially after coming to India in 1958, to understand that the more subtle an understanding of truth, the more you can see meanings in truth, many, many meanings. I mean, look at a man. He can be a father, he can be a husband, he can be a son, he can be a brother. The same man is many things. And so truth has many, many dimensions. And this is part of the fascination of Indian philosophy. What got me through my period of doubt, and I say this to those of you who have doubts spiritually, my doubts were resolved by one thing, love. I loved my guru. To me, finally, that was the only reality. It didn't matter anything else. And then finally I understood he knew much, much more than I in these things. His understanding was much subtler, much deeper, much more insightful. So anyway, the point here is that the meaning of the Mahabharata, the meaning of the Bhagavad Gita and so on is very subtle. And there are many truths to be taken from it, but there is this one central truth that will not change. And this is what I'm trying to explain to you here. And I'm going from the inside out rather than coming from the outside in. As the energy moves up the spine, man becomes more and more conscious. You see the Shudra types in man, big bellied usually, sort of, you can see them, just the way they sit, the way their whole attitude, their posture, everything indicates that their center of consciousness is in the lower chakras, the lower part of the spine. As they become more sophisticated, more understanding, their energy rises. Most people's consciousness in this world is from the Manipur chakra, the navel chakra on downward, centered there. The more spiritual you become, the more it becomes centered here. Finally, the seat of ego is, the seat of citta is in the heart. The seat of ego is in the medulla oblongata, at the base of the brain. And this is the one part of the body that cannot be operated on at its center, because it's the seat of your own being. It would produce violent convulsions and then death. And you see people, if they're very, very egotistical, then naturally the tension draws them backward and makes them, as they say, look down their noses. Well, tomorrow I will go into this more deeply, but it's a fascinating subject, and I'm very happy to be able to share what little I know with you all.